From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation for another week. On this edition of Fresh Air, we learn what makes a house a home with architecture writer Philip Langdon. Langdon's articles and his new book, American Houses, examine the ways architects, builders, and decorators make living in a house a delight or a nightmare. Also today, I speak with writer Sheila Ballantyne, the author of Norma Jean, the Termite Queen, has a new collection of short stories called Life on Earth. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from saxophonist and composer Ornette Coleman. And television critic David Bianculli checks in from L.A. with what's in store for the fall TV season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. A lot of us move into an empty space to live, but it takes much more before we can begin to call it a home. We bring to the apartment or house our own sense of space and try to meld it with what someone else designed a year or 100 years ago. We're drawn to areas of town or to certain houses where we feel comfortable. My guest today on Fresh Air is writer Philip Langdon, one of a few journalists who explores what it is that makes some spaces work and others fail. Philip Langdon writes about the American home in a regular column for The Atlantic, where he's written on new trends in retirement homes, closet space, kitchen design, computer smart homes, and historical renovation. Langdon is the author of American Houses and an earlier book, Orange Roofs, Golden Arches, The Architecture of the American Chain Restaurant. I asked Philip Langdon what makes where we live a home instead of just a house.
I think that what makes a difference is whether the house really fits the way people want to live. And I think that what you see now in American housing is a tendency by builders and developers to try to pay a little more attention to the differences in ways people live. One of the things that's really happened over a long period of time, I think, is that there's been this long-term trend toward informality. And as a result of the fact that we now have a lot more people who have both husband and wife out working all day long, they obviously don't have servants. They want to entertain people, and when they come home, they would like to be able to have a very convenient house in which people can get together, can talk to each other, can work in the kitchen, for instance, while having conversations. And so one of the things I think that's really important in houses is trying to get a good relationship of the rooms within the house.
Well, it seems many of these working couples use two rooms, the kitchen and the bedroom.
And I think the kitchen, is very important. I think it's the more important of those two areas because in the kitchen, obviously, you've got to spend time getting meals together, and you would like to be able to have conversations, see your kids, see your husband or wife, and when you have guests over, be able to entertain them. And I think that currently there's a lot more interest in designing kitchens so that there is, in fact, a way to work in the kitchen while still talking with other people. And I've been to a lot of houses around the country, for instance, in which the kitchen is now arranged so that it's relatively open to some sort of a social area. And in fact, now you very often see in some new subdivision houses a kind of a peninsula arrangement with a sink in it, for instance, so that somebody can work at preparing food, washing glasses, fixing drinks, and face people who have come over or talk with other members of the family, rather than having always that situation of having the kitchen sink looking out the window so that you're really putting your back to the other people in the house.
Which was also in part a reflection of how the houses were lived in before, with a woman at home alone, and the window was her view out on the world.
Exactly. I mean, it is nice to have that view out, but I think that came from a period when most women were staying at home all day long, and so there was really no need to think of how are you going to design this kitchen for interaction. And now I think that there's much more of a tendency to try to do that, and I think that's one of the advances that we're making in terms of trying to design houses that fit the way that people live their lives today.
Houses then tend to be turning inward The focus is now more in toward the family and toward what's actually going on in the house rather than looking out.
I think it's ironic, actually. I mean, you see people spending an awful lot of their time at work, and you would think, therefore, that the house should be less important and they would be getting lots of services outside. And yet, in fact, it seems as if there's this buildup of tension that has to be relieved by making the house into this kind of almost a self-sufficient compound to the extent that people are able to do that financially.
But that also gets to what it is we do with our money and stocking a house filled with appliances and electric gadgets with that idea of self-sufficiency.
Yeah, and so you see a lot of money going into kitchens, into making them much more elaborate. And then when you ask people how do they really use them, what really gets used an awful lot during the week is the microwave. And then on the idea, though, is to have as much as you can to do really large-scale things on weekends. The other part of the house, it seems to me, that's gotten a lot more emphasis in the last several years is the bedroom area. And currently, there's a lot of interest in creating master bedroom suites, which are very elaborate. The bathroom, which used to very often be a 5x7 or 5x8, relatively small area, utilitarian, is becoming much more lavish.
I was in a house the other day that had one of these master suites, and it had an enormous bed in it, and the right at the foot of the bed was the shower, and the shower was large enough for two people, and it was completely glassed in, so that you could be in bed there and watch your spouse, companion, taking a shower.
Mm-hmm.
Bedroom is an entertainment center, I guess.
I guess it is, a certain type of entertainment. And I think that there's this tremendous fantasy element that goes into the design of these bedroom suites. I mean, I think that most of them are not realistically designed in terms of the more expensive ones. I have talked with people, you know, they put in the big Whirlpool tub, and you ask them a year later, well, do you use it? And they said, well, we've used it about three times. You know, it takes a long time to fill the thing up, and we're pretty busy, so we take showers around here. But it's still there's an awful lot of image that goes into designing houses, and I think that the image is really driving a lot of what is being done in houses today. People would like to be able to show off just how well they're living. And so they would like to have all these wonderful things, even if they don't actually use them that much.
Well, you've admired the front porch for a long time, and in particular a development in Seaside, Florida, where front porches were mandated by the zoning code. And what was your experience in seeing, were these front porches actually used?
They were used occasionally, but I thought it was interesting in walking around Seaside. I spent about 4 days there seeing that when people sat out on their porches, they tended to sit really on their side porches. And when they went to architects, very often now they're asking for rear porches because although they like this old-fashioned idea of sociability, really what they'd like is a good deal of privacy. And so I think people still would like to be able to turn away from the public street when they're going to socialize with some friends.
I'm speaking with Philip Langdon. He writes about architecture and home design and is the author of the book American Houses. Well, Jane Jacobs was writing in the 1960s about the need to keep people on the streets, that streets are safest when more people use them, and porches lent an aura of neighborhood security. People out on the porches could see what was going on in the neighborhood. You're suggesting there's a turn toward the house as a hideout versus the house as a friendly, neighborly place, part of a community.
I think you see the house as a hideout, especially in California and a good deal of the Sun Belt. And you see it especially in areas where the houses are built on very tight lots, and the attempt is to create this area away from everybody else at the back of the house. I think there's still a lot of regional variation around the country. And I think that if you go through the Midwest, and I've spent a week, for instance, in the Chicago suburbs, I was sort of surprised to see that quite in contrast to what you see in California and the Sun Belt, you still see houses that are pretty much exposed to their neighbors in terms of when somebody's in the backyard, you're pretty much on public view of your neighbors. The houses do front on the streets, And so I think we have a lot of ideas that vary regionally, and there's really a lot of debate going on now about whether we should have more of a kind of a public consciousness, try to put more life into the public realm. One of the nice things about the town of Seaside is that although people weren't out on those front porches a lot, you can still see the people on their side porches. And in fact, the streets themselves were designed with picket fences fairly close to the house, so that you felt that you were in this special area that was very well defined. The streets were relatively narrow and had that feeling of being kind of an outdoor room, and people like to walk down the streets. I think when you build very wide streets, people don't want to walk down those streets. It gets to feel like just a big void. And there are a number of designers around the country who are trying to orient the house so that, yes, it will provide some privacy that you need, but it's also going to try to create a more inviting public environment and make it possible for people to walk, for instance, from their home to some of the services that they need, to do some shopping, for instance, without always having to drive.
You've quoted a British town planner as saying, "A place without old buildings is like a person without a memory." Are developers trying to put instant history into new projects when they build houses that are throwbacks, they look like colonial, they look like Tudor? What is it that's attracting customers?
Well, I think that people get a tremendous amount of comfort out of housing that goes back to something that they've seen in the past. And I was amazed just last week to get a publication from the remodeling industry group at the National Association of Home Builders, which you'd think would be the last group that would be really interested in doing things in an old-fashioned way. And the illustration that they sent, the project that they featured, was a 1950s one-story house that the remodeler managed to turn into something that was a two-story house that looked like it had been built about 1900. I think that first of all, people admire the craftsmanship that they associate with those older houses. And they also, I think, carry in their heads a vision of these houses of being places that were really home, that have an emotional resonance, that something brand new and radically different from the past is not able to deliver.
When people say, "I want a home," what are they talking about? What to them do you think is in the mind about a home? What makes a home a home?
I think that they want a safe place, a place where they can feel comfortable with their immediate family, where they can have friends over. I think that there's a sense of solace that comes out of home. And so I think that people really are trying to make their houses comfortable and warm places. And at the same time, though, they would really like to be able to do something that the people that they hang around with will also respect. And so I think that they're, in a way, they are driven by two conflicting things. One is to just make that house comfortable and make it a good place for their family life. And the other is to make it something that is going to meet the expectations that they think other people have for them. And as a result, for instance, you see a lot of emphasis now on doing fairly elaborate foyers for some of the more expensive houses, even though hardly any time is spent in the foyer, obviously.
But it is that grand attempt at status.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few of them. For instance, they're two stories tall. They very often have a second floor window so that you have light coming in. I mean, they're really very nice, but hardly practical. You could use the space in much more practical ways. But I think that a lot of people are driven by this need to do something that is going to be an expression of how far they've come in life.
And that's always been part of the American dream.
It has been, but it seems to me that the need seems somehow to be more intense. It's been more intense for the last few years. I think people have felt that they ought to be making good money, they ought to be living good lives, and they ought to be able to show that. And I think that in the last several years, it's been it's been okay. People have felt that it's been okay to make more of a show of how well you're doing. And that's made quite an impact, I think, on, say, the upper half of the housing market. We still have a lot of so-called affordable houses in which we don't see this big show being made. But I think that...
But nevertheless, it is a show even nowadays to be able to own a house.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's very tough to do it.
I mean, there's the question. Do you own or are you a renter? I mean, there's a real distinction. I once had an encounter with a neighbor of mine, and we were having a discussion about what to do about the fence, and talking with the contractor that the neighbor had brought in, and she said, "Don't pay any attention to him. He's just a renter."
That's
and here,
true.
Right in the midst of a neighborhood, was this very keen class distinction that was drawn.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's... That says something really about this whole problem of housing affordability. I think that there's a lot of lip service paid to producing affordable houses, but in fact, those who already have houses really don't want the price of houses to go down very much. They like the idea that they're having an appreciation of the value of their real estate. And I think that there's this kind of a economic class consciousness, and people really think that they have reached the level of owning a house, and they're not eager to change, say, the zoning regulations to allow smaller houses into their neighborhoods.
It's a matter of, I've got mine now. You'll just have to struggle as much.
Exactly. Or more, because actually many of the people who now own houses bought them when the prices were considerably lower. I think it's one of the big issues that we haven't worked out in our minds yet, because people who are buying houses are buying investments, and they would like to make the most of that investment over time.
Well, that is an interesting switch from a house just a shelter to a tax shelter.
Yeah, well, the house really is so many different things for people. I mean, it's the biggest way that people save money in this country, and people want to profit by that investment. This is a safe place to put their money, and they can enjoy what they've put their money in a way that they certainly can't with a certificate of deposit.
What developments do you admire?
Well,
for instance, you've written about a development east of San Francisco near Danville called Blackhawk, a region of phenomenally expensive homes.
That was not one I admired.
That was not one you admired. How come?
That was. A prime representation, I think, of the ostentation that you see at the top of the housing market of trying to make the roofs as complex as you can, to incorporate as many rich-looking entries into the houses, to sort of get all of the visible manifestations of wealth onto those houses. But at the same time, it seemed to me that there was no sense of community in that place. Every house was actually carved onto a hillside pad, a flat piece of land, and then you had
a bulldozed flat on the hill.
Despite all the environmental progress that's been made, that kind of thing is still very common. Blackhawk was not one of the places that I liked. One of the places I did like was a place called Davis, California, or Village Homes in Davis, California. And in this development, the idea was to do a development that, first of all, would be energy conscious. Many of the houses are solar houses and built in a very energy efficient manner. Second, they tried not to pipe all of the water underground and have really elaborate works of civil engineering. Instead, they managed to put some of the stormwater runoff on the surface in just grassy or gravel ditches, and actually in an area where there are little kids. I mean, kids love to play in things like that. And they saved something like $800 per house by doing this. Then they could take the $800 savings per house, and they could put in a lot more landscape. And as a result of that, they could put in... they had a large number of fruit trees they put in, and then they instituted a program whereby The community took responsibility for these, and teenage kids and others could take care of the harvesting and care of the fruit trees. And they could therefore earn some money with which to support some athletic facilities within the complex. And it seemed to me that one thing sort of fed into another. They had a sense of...
It got back to that idea of a common green, where people would sort of moor their cows, let their cows graze all in common.
Yeah, I think that there was
a
sense of community that came both from the environment and from the kinds of shared landscape and the uses that they could make of that shared landscape. And I think that that's still relatively rare, but I think that it's something that's worth shooting for.
My guest is Philip Langdon, author of the book American Houses. We'll talk more about what makes a place after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Philip Langdon. He's written extensively about home design for many publications, and he's the author of the book American Houses. He's also written about American chain restaurants in the book Orange Roofs, Golden Arches. You seem to have an affection for the designs of the 50s, those root beer hamburger stands and the car hops. Was there more of a community in those kinds of fast food places?
There was a kind of a community, but it was a pretty boisterous community. I mean, the reason that we don't have a lot of those places is that after a while, all the neighbors got together and tried to close them down or limit their hours. It was a community, but they left a lot of litter, and they were very noisy. Some of them really, really produced an interesting evening life that was not so boisterous, and I kind of miss that.
So was this part of the vision of a chain like McDonald's to try and keep teenagers from gathering?
Oh, they always wanted to do that. And then ultimately, I think the reason, half of the reason that they introduced seating indoors was to get all those people out of the parking lot where they were making a lot of noise and revving up their engines and get them inside so that they would consume their meals and get on their way.
Which is part of the idea of fast food, move the people out quickly,
mm-hmm.
along with those hamburgers.
Volume is everything.
At one time, chains like McDonald's were expanding it. I think you wrote one new outlet every 17 hours?
I think that's about right. And McDonald's still is. They just do a phenomenal business. And because they have everything worked out to a scientific level of production. And in fact, it goes all the way back really to the McDonald brothers, Richard and Maurice, who back in the early 1950s were pioneering their chain. And they had worked out this thing so that they could serve a customer in 20 seconds. And this was before Ray Kroc ever came along, just by standardizing the menu and standardizing all the operations, getting all of the equipment in the exact right spot in the restaurant so that there would be absolutely not one step needed in beyond the minimum, and, of course, getting the customer to take things away himself.
Part of the success of the McDonald's has been, and all of these chain restaurants has been their identifiability. You can drive down a commercial strip anywhere and you might know what it is you're getting into. Yet there have been cities that have fought this look. In Vancouver, San Francisco, other cities I've seen, these chain stores are now forced to blend into a community style. Does this seem to be going on throughout the country, the community is sort of taking back control through zoning regulations?
I think it's happening in places that are populated by pretty affluent and well-educated people. It's happening in historic areas. I think it's happening in cities, especially large cities. But you can still go down the strip and you can still see that same image building repeated thousands of times as you drive across the country. I think that in general, that this effort to try to get something that relates to the community is a good one. the hardest thing, I guess, is to get the chain to really put a significant amount of work into it rather than doing something that is just very easy to get through. For instance, McDonald's came up with a series of simple facade variations on their standard building so that they do a so-called Tudor, they had quite a number of different variations, and it looks like wallpaper on the exterior of their standard building. Now, that I think is not really producing the kind of relationship to the existing community that is good in, I think, any kind of a commercial development.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back into the house and far into the house. You recently wrote an article for Atlantic in your home column on the notion of closets, of storage space, as the last sanctuary of American life. I mean, that's where we kept our skeletons, and that's where some people chose to come from. And now we're inviting people in to help us organize our closets. What's going on here?
Well, I think one thing that has gone on is that millions of women decided they weren't going to stay home all day. They were going to go to work. And when they went out to work, there was obviously there was less time available to clean up after everybody in the family. So therefore, you have to have more storage space because you're talking about a bigger wardrobe with both the man and the woman, I think, going off to work every day, and less time to get everything in order. And so there's been this. Now there are several companies around. Several companies around that are specializing in coming into your house and reorganizing your closets so that everything is organized, so that you can see everything and get more use out of the existing closet space. Rather than, for instance, the old idea was you simply had a shelf with a pole, and of course the short things and the long things both hung from that same pole and.
Both overcoats and jackets, yeah.
And so you wasted a lot of space. Now the tendency is to try to subdivide the closet and get a lot of stuff into that closet. I think it seems that people have more and more things, and the problem is, where are you going to put them?
What have you done about your own house? Are you in your dream house?
Well,
is it a home for you?
Yes. Oh, I love it. We're in a house. We're in an old house. I love old houses, and we have one built in 1911, which someone came along in 1952 and did the back in thermopane modern. And so it's one of these houses with a split personality that looks like a 1911 classical revival house on the street. But in fact, you come in and you have 20 feet of thermopane glass looking out onto the backyard.
Do you have enough closet space?
we do, fortunately. We've got lots of storage.
Well, Philip Langdon, thank you very much for coming in and spending some time with us here today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Philip Langdon's books include American Houses and Orange Roofs, Golden Arches, The Architecture of American Chain Restaurants. And he also writes a regular column, Home, that appears in The Atlantic magazine. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with science fiction writer Samuel Delaney. He's just written a memoir of his experiences growing up black, gay, and a writer of science fiction in Greenwich Village in the early 60s. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. The stories in Sheila Ballantyne's new collection all have death as the antagonist. Coming up, Ballantyne talks about her using death as a way to explore the extremes of life. Composer and saxophonist Ornette Coleman has a new album of his harmelodic jazz, and this time Coleman's joined by an unlikely collaborator, Grateful Dead guitarist Jerry Garcia. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review. And television critic David Bianculli discusses what the new TV season will look like now that the writer's strike is finally over. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. United Nations Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar has announced that a ceasefire in the Iran-Iraq war will begin on August 20th. The truce will be supervised by more than 350 UN troops. This military observer group will be stationed in the Gulf for 6 months, with one detachment in Iran and one in Iraq. In Tehran today, Iran's top leadership said the eight-year-old war is finally coming to a close. Both Iran and Iraq reported only minor skirmishes today. President Reagan called the Gulf War ceasefire an important first step in ending the eight-year war. He praised the efforts of United Nations Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar, and the president made his comments to a convention of the National Governors Association in Cincinnati. He also talked up the economic policies of his administration.
These policies are the wave of the future. Country after country is reducing taxes, cutting regulation, reducing the role of government, and letting entrepreneurs and working people build new factories, new jobs, and new futures for themselves and their families.
Mr. Reagan asserted that the industrial Midwest, a region sometimes referred to as the Rust Belt, has enjoyed an economic revival under the Republicans. According to a Senate aide, the White House and Republican senators today rejected an aid package for the Nicaraguan Contras worked out last week by Senate Democrats. The Democratic plan calls for $27 million in non-lethal humanitarian aid to the anti-Sandinista rebels. Democratic leaders had hoped to work out a bipartisan agreement on Contra aid to defuse the potential political embarrassment caused by the disagreement between the party's presidential and vice presidential candidates on aid to the rebels. Today's rejection by the Republicans appears to end those hopes. Secretary of State George Shultz was not hurt today in an apparent bomb attack on his motorcade outside La Paz, Bolivia. State Department spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley.
There was an explosion during the secretary's motorcade in La Paz, Bolivia, during the period when he was going from the airport into the city.
The Bolivian government blamed the attack on Shultz's motorcade and another bombing today at the U.S. commissary in La Paz on cocaine traffickers. No injuries were reported in either bombing, although the entrance to the commissary building was damaged. Shultz is on a 10-day, nine-country Latin American tour aimed at gaining support for the Reagan administration's policies. In Burma today, tens of thousands of people took to the streets to protest the new hardline government of Sein Lwin. Four people reportedly were killed and 30 injured. Christopher Gunness has more.
The day reportedly began quietly in Rangoon, with hundreds of students said to have taken to the streets in peaceful anti-government demonstrations. However, later, two crowds formed, each of over 3,000 people. One marched northwards from the city centre, gathering support as it converged on the university. Students, many wearing masks, chanted anti-government slogans and made speeches calling for democracy. Eventually, the security forces ordered them to disperse, and gradually the protesters left the campus area. Another crowd gathered in the southwest of the capital and marched on government offices at the city center. No violence was reported in Rangoon, but the authorities announced that 45 people had been arrested. They also said that 17 were detained yesterday.
The BBC's Christopher Gunness. South Korean youths hurled firebombs and battled riot police today in the second straight day of protests. The students are demonstrating against a government ban on meetings between North and South Korean students who want to see their two countries reunified. Stock prices fell on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 10 points to close at 2108.64. This is NPR News in Washington. I'm Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new recording by composer and alto saxophonist Ornette Coleman and his electric band, Primetime. The music is based on what Coleman calls harmelotic theory, the word harmelotic being a contraction of harmony, motion, and melody. Kevin says there's confusion about what the term means, but the new recording lets you hear what Coleman is talking about, and more people are likely to listen because Grateful Dead guitarist Jerry Garcia is playing with the band.
A few months ago, a friend told me with a snicker that the Grateful Dead's guitarist Jerry Garcia was recording with my hero, Ornette Coleman. He waited for me to explode. I told him it sounded like a good idea, which confused my friend. I said, remember the old Dead song Tennessee Jed, where Garcia kept mulling over one phrase and then kicked it up a couple of notes higher? Modulations like that are the key to how Ornette Coleman's music works, the system for improvisers he calls harmelotics. Playing harmelotically, you can paraphrase a melody or improvise a new one, like any jazz musician. But in a harmelotic band, each musician may play that melody in any key or at any tempo. Such freedom leads to polytonal, polyrhythmic music, but the basic idea is simple. Since everyone's playing the same tune, the sound will make sense if the musicians listen to each other. Coleman's band Prime Time sounds better than ever on his wonderful new album, Virgin Beauty, for the Portrait label. It's a painless lesson in how harmelotics works. You can hear the way Coleman uses rhythmic modulation on Bourgeois Boogie, his rethink of Grazin' in the Grass. Stating the circular melody on alto sax, Coleman speeds up the main phrase on the third repeat, changing the tension in the line the way a leap into another key would. Jerry Garcia is on three of Virgin Beauty's 11 tracks, but he's less guest star than team player. Garcia blends into the general hubbub of Prime Time's two guitars, two electric basses, and two drummers. All those rattling strings underscore the parallels between Prime Time's music and guitar-heavy African pop, but this band has been together since the mid-70s, long before Afropop became a fad. Coleman's harmelotic method can be applied to any music. His composition Happy Hour is a bar band's hoedown. The way the guitarists play one whining lick in several keys is harmelotic too. Thank you. Primetime has never sounded more flexible or light on its beat. I like the way the two bass players stay out of each other's way. But I don't mind that Coleman may upstage the group. As a saxophonist, he has a weakness for a few pet phrases, but his sound is so down-home and bluesy, he always sings from and to the heart. Here's a bit of his dirge, Unknown Artist. Ornette Coleman's music is usually thought of as difficult to listen to. But with Deadheads in his corner, Third World Rhythms on tap, and plenty of his alto out front, Coleman's never had a better shot at having a hit. If there's any justice, Virgin Beauty will sell a zillion.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Virgin Beauty, the latest from Ornette Coleman, is on the Portrait label. This is Fresh Air. Sheila Ballantyne writes both funny and serious stories. In her new collection of six stories, Life on Earth, she turns her comic ear to issues of death and mortality. The first three stories are about the sometimes absurd details surrounding the business of death. The other stories are more reflective, marking changes over the 14 years she wrote these stories. Ballantyne has written two novels, Norma Jean, The Termite Queen, and Imaginary Crimes. Norma Jean, her best-known novel, was written in 1975, and it's still in print. It's about a housewife who wants to change her suburban existence. It's a comic novel of family life tinged with imaginings of horrid deaths inspired by those ghastly newspaper fillers. Ballantyne teaches writing at Mills College in Oakland, California, and contributes frequently to the New York Times book review section. I asked Sheila Ballantyne to read from her story, Perpetual Care, which received the O. Henry Award for Best Short Story in 1977. In the story, the narrator visits a columbarium, a depository for ashes, to collect her father's remains.
I became aware of a strange sound and, turning, noticed the 12-foot water fountain cascading at the far end of the hall. It had orange spotlights playing on it. There were also 6 to 8 gigantic tanks of tropical fish. Do you have anything like that in your columbarium? Well, you haven't heard the half of it, V.O. There were carpets, ramps, and, are you ready, muzak. But that isn't what knocked me out. The columbarium in Oakland has that, organ music, muzak. My first visit there, I went crazy looking for the man playing the organ. It wasn't until I'd covered the entire place that I realized it was coming out of the ceiling. No, it wasn't that the trend is undoubtedly toward muzak in mausoleums. It was that here, in this isolated architect-designed death house on a windswept hill, dead center of the far west, they were playing You and the Night and the Music. I couldn't help myself, V.O. I started dancing. The caretaker was in the washroom filling the water vases. I wouldn't have done it with him around. I danced up the ramp, past the colored fountain, to the upper level. By this time, the tune on the tape was It Had to Be You. I couldn't help slowing down. I was on the verge of tears.
That was from your story, Perpetual Care, set there in a columbarium. There's a lot of emotional turmoil that comes up at funerals, and we tend to distance ourselves by using euphemisms. So-and-so's passed on, they've passed away, They're no longer here. Bankers sometimes say, well, the will has matured.
Never heard that one.
You know, there's just something that we cannot bring ourselves to say that someone died or to speak of death in very frank terms. And one thing about your stories is that they grasp it. And you deal very frankly with this issue. Was this something painful for you to do?
Well, I think, yes, it was, but more to the point, it was urgent. I have been accused, in this book in particular, of being death-obsessed because there happened to be quite a few, if not all, of the stories in one way or another concern themselves with issues of mortality. And I don't experience it that way. I don't perceive it that way, although I could see why others might, for the very reasons you cited. I see my strongest guiding feeling throughout was one of wishing to explore extreme regions, really, inner emotional states and mental regions that are, I guess, triggered or ignited by crises.
I was struck by an observation you made in the book about how people, say, in middle-aged, are buffered from the idea of immortality because their parents are still alive.
Mm-hmm.
But when their parents die, then there's no one left between themselves and eternity. Could you explore a bit about how you thought about this?
Well, I think that is the guiding issue with the first three stories, that you could almost say that one doesn't get to write about certain subjects until certain things in reality will trigger events that then force them to. I mean, I think all writers write in order to shape existence in some way, or at least to reshape it as a means of trying to make some sense out of it. Because I mean, life is pretty random and chaotic. So you could say that the bottom line is that if you write about it, you get to control it, you get to shape it, you get to perhaps, and by doing so, find some answers for yourself, or maybe find no answers and then accept that there are no answers. But at least you've gone through the process, and I think certain life events do trigger the impulse to explore things that are, I mean, in my case, just incomprehensible. I mean, obviously, we don't always go around thinking, why are we here? But fundamentally, we do at some point.
Your comment about the buffer that an older generation serves for a younger generation to keep them from facing the questions of mortality is, I think, in some ways moot nowadays with people dying of drug overdoses, people dying of AIDS.
It has completely reversed itself in some ways.
Do you see your book as a guide
No.
to coping with these issues in any way?
I've received some mail that would suggest that it may become that. I mean, it already has in some instances. I do think that one of the reasons we read literature is to find reflections and echoes of things in our lives and see how they're addressed by other people. And so in that sense, I think everything that's written that's true will find its audience.
I want to tell you a couple of stories about my my grandmother. My grandmother, I think, knew that her time was near, and sometimes I'd call her to find out how she was doing. And she would say, well, you know, a funny thing happened on the way to Hill and Hill, being the family mortuary. That's how she'd preface her adventures that she was having. And she'd kind of laugh about it. It was like she reached a certain point of like 85, and,
mm-hmm.
and she was ready.
In other words, it was already prefigured in her mind. It became a kind of dominant image.
Well, I just think that she was aware of it,
mm-hmm.
and she would say, and she would laugh about it. I mean, she knows that this is how life ends, and so she incorporated that as part of her general sort of humor of the world.
Mm-hmm.
My aunt also, when taking her ashes to be buried, stopped off at a restaurant the night before and put the tin up on the table,
mm-hmm.
so that my aunt and my grandmother could have a last martini together.
Now, why don't you write about that? That's your story.
But it seems that's one of the things about your first stories in your book that resonated with me in my experience with death. I've had friends who've died of sudden accidental death, mm-hmm. as well as people who've died of old age. And my reaction in each case is somehow different, but there's something comforting about the notion of humor and this odd sort of sense of the peripheral activities that go around someone's death.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's possible that those get written about partly as comic relief. I mean, you have to have some relief on this subject. And as a kind of diversion, a diversionary tactic, you know, that sometimes instead of staring at something head on, I mean, it's like looking into the sun. If you look at the sun, you essentially look around it. You're aware of it, but it's so overwhelming. I mean, you'd be blinded by it. And I think that these details tend to carry more weight for that reason.
Well, do you feel writing here about death has been sort of a dead end, so to speak? If you've written about death as sort of the subject where you're ultimately straining your sense of imagination.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you just come back to writing about ordinary life?
It's a big problem. Well, in a way, it's a relief to come back to ordinary life. And I think that one of the things that hasn't been too often mentioned about life on Earth is that, yes, these are the things that are being addressed, but that in the end, this we are here. This is our time. This is our life on Earth. And for me, it's almost as though one has to come full cycle in order to really appreciate that this is the only life we have, and its task is to live it well.
Well, Sheila Ballantyne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sheila Ballantyne's new collection of short stories, Life on Earth, is published by Simon & Schuster. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up later from National Public Radio. Co-host Alex Chadwick is with me on the line from Washington. Alex, what's in the news that you'll be covering today?
Sedge, there was a bombing today in Bolivia. Someone threw a bomb at the car that carried the U.S. Secretary of State, George Shultz. Mr. Shultz was not injured, but we'll cover that story and find out what happened. Vice President Bush is attacking his political opponent for this fall, Governor Dukakis, the Democratic presidential candidate. Today, Mr. Bush called Mr. Dukakis the stealth candidate, meaning, I think, that Mr. Dukakis is not really saying what he is and needs to come out a little bit more. And we'll cover newspaper acquisitions by the Australian news magnate Rupert Murdoch.
Yes, he's been very busy. Thanks, Alex. You can hear those stories and more coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The 5-month-old television and movie writers' strike has just ended. Our television critic David Biancooley is in Los Angeles, where he's participating in a TV critics' press tour. For 2 weeks now, David has been talking with the television executives, meeting producers and stars about the fall season. He's with us now on the horn from his hotel room out on the coast, just across the street from Universal Studios. Well, so when will the fall season actually start? December?
There's not going to be an actual rollout week. It looks now that September is pretty much shot at CBS and at ABC. NBC is announcing a lot of its stuff coming back in terms of its returning shows.
Huh. So actually very few new shows.
Very few new shows in terms of if anybody was reading TV enough to know what was announced by the networks in May among the new fall series, most of them are not going to show up until late October, early November.
So a few new themes in the new season, but I imagine lawyers will still be big. How about women heroines?
Actually, women heroines are part of it, but the biggest thing, and this is sort of scary, is moonlighting clones. The strike has delayed this a little bit, but moonlighting was hot when everybody went into production a year ago on things that were going to come out this season. So everybody is talking smart to everybody else and just barely escaping going to bed with one another, and it's that sort of a deal. It's a pretty tiresome trend.
Well, the thing I noticed about Moonlighting is that the writing deteriorated from its first season.
Yes.
So is the writing going to be at a par with Moonlighting in its early days or at its nadir?
Well, I haven't seen any sparkling writing. The best that I can say is that there's one show, Murphy's Law, which does Moonlighting the way Moonlighting used to do Moonlighting. So that's, I guess, a compliment, but I'm not really excited about seeing Moonlighting the way it used to be anymore. There's a new show called Midnight Caller with Gary Cole, who starred in Fatal Vision, and that looks like a fairly interesting show. My hopes are pinned on a show called Tattingers, which is a new show by the makers of St. Elsewhere. The pilot of that looks a little violent, but very interesting and well cast. But it really is a crapshoot at this point in the game.
What have the writers been doing during this time? Have they been actually sitting at their word processors churning out material that they can hand in when the strike's over? Have they been trying to meet their mortgage payments by becoming waiters?
I don't know. I've talked to a whole bunch of different writers. Some of them say that they expect that now that the strike is over, they're going to look into a bottom drawer of their word processor office, and all of a sudden, all these scripts will appear magically. So some of them have been working without telling anyone.
The networks have long denigrated cable television. Are they still doing that out there on the coast?
They're trying to, but it's a much harder sell. Cable may be the only big winner of the strike because through co-production deals abroad and the fact that they were not idle during the strike period, they've got a big lineup. I mean, they are targeting September and October as a time to be very competitive. And so I think that they're hoping that a lot of people, realizing that the networks are not doing good stuff or stuff that is up to their own par, may seek viable alternatives, and they'll be there.
Well, thank you, David.
Okay, thanks a lot.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's show. On tomorrow's show, I speak with novelist Don DeLillo. He's talked very little about his previous novels, like Americana, End Zone, and the bestseller and American Book Award winner, White Noise. But DeLillo is talking again, and this time about Libra, his new novel based on the assassination of President Kennedy and the life of Lee Harvey Oswald. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Oklahoma guitarist Eddie Cochran. Like his friend Buddy Holly, Cochran died at the height of his popularity. And like Holly, his hits like Summertime Blues and Come On Everybody continue to be recorded. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.